Thursday, April 15th. In the morning, Caitlin and Anne were the first to leave, returning to New Avalon the same way they'd come shortly after Corwin rose for the day. For a moment, it looked like they might have to leave without Sergei, but he did eventually relent, parting from Neri with a great grumbling sigh. The polar bear dog looked a bit downcast, but took it better than she had last time. There was at least no mournful howling on this occasion. Perhaps she had more confidence that she'd see the tiger again this time, since he'd already reappeared once. "By the time you guys get back here," Utina remarked as Corwin prepared Cora's front window for their departure, "we should have the house at least partway up." "The general arrangement prints don't really give you a feel for what it's going to look like on the site," Cora added. "But I think it's really shaping up to be something special." "I can't wait to see it in person," Kate said, then added mischievously, "Junichan, on the other hand, is looking forward to other things."
"Sensei,"
said Anne, reddening, while Karana giggled and Azana very tactfully did not. Instead, she smiled and said, "We're looking forward to having you with us, too. Perhaps if Master Caitlin agrees, you can come on the road with us for a while." "We've got a 2-week road trip in June," Karana added, nodding agreement. "Big loop of the Earth Kingdom, mostly. Gaipan, Omashu, Gaoling, Nightvale, 3 games in BSS, then up to Toolsville and Frostbite Point before heading home. Should be good times, except for the last part," she added with a wink. Hugs all around, and ladies and tiger were gone, dispatched back to a place where it was, rather startlingly, a balmy spring day. When Corwin returned a few moments later, those who were left squared away their own things, put on their winter gear, and headed out to see what might be going on. The Senna Common was clean and empty, all the little booths and things knocked down in the early hours and packed away until they would be needed again. Even the ashes and soot from the bonfire were gone. The only trace of the previous night's festivities that remained in daylight was Karana's gleaming ice sculpture at the far end, which would be there until the spring thaw claimed it in October or November. In the middle of the common, Nemo was pre-flighting Vayu, checking that his saddle was properly affixed and that all was otherwise well with him. He'd spent the night outside, there being no building in Senna large enough to accommodate him, but it would take more than one relatively mild Antarctic evening to trouble a sky bison, and the locals had been very generous with the fruit and whatnot. He had no complaints. She had just reached the conclusion that all was in order when she noticed that someone was standing a few yards away, watching her. At first, she assumed it was Kuvi, come to see her off, a thought she found curiously pleasing. He was a very polite and rather handsome young man, and she'd enjoyed the time they'd spent together during the festival, however awkward it had been, and it had been mightily awkward, particularly at first. When she completed her work and looked up, though, she saw to her surprise that it was Lakpa. If anything, her sister looked, and made her feel, more awkward than Karana's cousin would have. Nima's first instinct was to go on ignoring Lakpa, as she'd been doing steadily for the last few weeks. It seemed to be working, after all, and why second-guess success? That strategy, however, was predicated on Lakpa in turn ignoring her, and right now she wasn't keeping up her end. She was very plainly noticing her younger sister. It ruined the effect. In order to ignore her now, Nemo would have to come right out and snub her, and that felt wrong somehow. Instead, with a nonchalance that was largely feigned, she asked, "Yes?" Lakpa opened her mouth, closed it again, and sighed. "Look, Nemo," she said, "I know you're mad at me." Nemo shook her head. "No," she said, "I'm not mad at you." "Is that so? Then I guess I must have imagined that you haven't even acknowledged my presence in weeks." I never said I wasn't avoiding you, said Nima. Why would you do that if you're not angry? Lakva countered. Something Cora told me one of her old friends once said, long before we were born, Nima replied coolly. Even the dumbest animal eventually learns to stay away from fire, or words to that effect. Lakpa scowled and looked as if she might retort, but then her face fell and she sighed again, shoulders sagging. I guess I earned that, she said. Look, I'm sorry about the Corwin thing, she blurted. It was too far. It was none of my business. I saw you standing in the doorway looking at him, and I just did it. She looked at her hands, as if not quite certain what she should do with them, and repeated, just above a mumble, I'm sorry. Nima regarded her sister for a few seconds, her expression hard to read. When she spoke again, what she said was so unexpected it made Lakpa look up in surprise. Are you okay? Lakpa blinked at her. Am I? For a second, she thought Nima was being sarcastic, implying that Lakpa must be feeling ill if she were actually apologizing for something. But the look of unfiltered concern on the younger air nomad's face would have put the lie to that, even if Lakpa hadn't realized a moment after thinking it how utterly out of character for Nima that would be. That's something I would do, she thought with another little pang of shame. I'm not sure, she admitted after a moment. I have a lot of things on my mind lately. That's no excuse for what I did, she added, lest Nima think she was trying to walk back her apology. But it's the truth. She shook her head. I don't know if I'm okay. Well, said Nima a trifle awkwardly, if there's anything I can do to help you. Lakpa managed a wan smile. Thanks, but I'm sort of working on it with Nall. She would have made something snide out of that, too, probably involving the phrase, I'll bet you are. But Nima only nodded, her face serious. Okay, she said. Just let me know if you want to talk. I'll be around. Lakpa just stood looking at her for a few seconds, unable to come up with anything to say, but Nima didn't seem to expect anything. She just turned and went to say goodbye to the others, who were coming across the common by then. Nall joined them partway there, going to stand next to Lakpa, while the rest gathered to see Nima off. Hey, Nima, I've got a message for you, said Karana cheerfully. Kuvi had to leave at first light to help his grandma get home to Kurluktuk, but he wanted me to let you know, and I quote, and here she screwed up her face into a reasonably good imitation of her teenage cousin's slightly befuddled, slightly frightened look, and pitched her voice lower. It was great meeting her, I hope I see her again, sometime. End quote. Handsome and articulate, Maki observed with a mischievous smile. Better not let that one get away. Nima smiled, blushing slightly, and gently chided the Kyoshi warrior for her uncharitability, before telling Karana, Well, if you're in touch with him again before I am, please tell him I had a good time. Perhaps I'll see him again when next I'm in the area. You want his address? Karana asked, then grinned and added, No point in giving you his phone number unless you like paying 35 fen a minute for silence. Had she been feeling a little more like herself, Lakpa would probably have had something playful but biting to say about detachment at that juncture, but her heart wasn't in it today, and she let it go by as Nima said she would like that, thank you, and tucked the note Karana gave her away in her robes. "Will you beat us back to Air Temple Island?" Korra asked her as she climbed up to her perch on Vayu's neck. "I'm not sure," Nima replied. "It depends on how long it takes me to finish my business at the Southern Air Temple. I probably will. At worst, I'll only be a day or two behind you." "Well, we'll see you there," said Utina. "Don't stay away too long." "I won't," Nima promised. "Safe travels, everyone. I'll see you soon. Oh, Lakpa?" Lakpa looked up from a quiet consultation with Nal, surprised. "Yes?" "If you two have time," said Nima, "you should stop by the Southern Air Temple yourselves on the way home. That way you won't actually have to lie to Great-Grandmother when she asks you about your visit." Once again, coming from anyone else, that remark would have had an archly cutting edge. But once again, it was offered as plain and simple advice, without any perceptible subtext at all. Lakpa glanced at Nal, who nodded with a faint half-smile, then turned back to her sister and gave her an airbender salute and a short bow. "Thank you, Master Nima," she said, and the younger air nomad realized it was the first time her elder sister had ever called her that sincerely. Nima smiled and returned the salute. "See you there," she said, and then, "Vayu, yip yip." Lakpa stood and watched her sister's sky bison dwindle toward the northern horizon, a look of mixed confusion and something like awe on her face. Then, when Nima and Vayu were out of sight, she shook herself slightly, turned to Nal, and asked in a tone more like her old self, "Think we can beat her there?" Nal chuckled. "You just watch me work," he replied. Then, a bit awkwardly, he turned to the others and said, "So hey, we'll see you guys in a while, yeah?" "You know where to find us," said Corwin, a trifle glumly. "Yeah, well..." Nal ruffled his own hair, a gesture similar to the back of the head one both Corwin and Utina often did at moments like this, then said, "Might not be long now. I hope. We'll see." He hesitated, as if there were more he wanted to say, but then he just shrugged and said, "Later," before suddenly and dramatically assuming his full dragon form. Lakpa sprang nimbly onto his back at the base of his long neck, her hands digging into his shaggy white fur for support, and with one great wing beat that set up a swirling cloud of snow, he launched himself into the sky and sped off as if in pursuit of Vayu.
"That guy is weird," Garnet interjected into the slightly puzzled silence left behind. "Seriously, is he having a midlife crisis or something?"
"Maybe something like that," Corwin mused.
"Well, I guess it's about time for us to hit the trail too," said Korra. "Places for people to be and all that."
"Yeah, Zana and I have to meet Juan and Jin Bao by noon tomorrow," said Karana.
"Plenty of time," said Ryo. "That's the big advantage of flying Sato Air," he added with a grin. "You never have to worry about the plane leaving without you."
The rest of them got back to Nanisivik in their two boats an hour or so after nightfall. That was not particularly late at night this time of year, so they had plenty of time to enjoy another leisurely dinner in town. This time they went to the harbor side, a fairly fancy seafood place, naturally, on the waterfront, where their table by one of the grand windows had an excellent view of the Mirai at her mooring.
"Are you guys headed out tonight, or are you going to wait till morning?" Maki asked Ryo and the fire ferrets as they all awaited their entrees.
"Do I get a vote?" Garnet wondered.
"Well, I do need night hours," Karana mused. Then she yawned faintly into the back of one hand and added wryly,
but I need sleep more.
The 265 can get you to Jinbao in a little under 4 hours, Minami pointed out. So long as your wheel's up by 7:30 or so, you should be fine.
Ryo nodded. That's what I was thinking.
Enthi gave Karana a curious look across the table, but her question was forestalled temporarily by the arrival of a small squad of kitchen runners with their meals. Only when operations were completed and the staff had departed was she able to ask,
Are you a pilot, Karana?
Karana nodded.
Sure am. Got my instrument rating. Multi-engine, too. I'm working on my commercial certificate now. That's what I need the hours for. You have to log a lot of flying hours to qualify for one of those. I don't have a ton of spare time, so it's going to take me a while, but...
She shrugged.
I keep plugging.
She indicated Ryo and Minami with her chopsticks and went on. These guys have been helping me out a lot, letting me use one of their airplanes whenever I have a little time.
It's our pleasure, believe me, Minami told her with a smile. Future Industries may not sponsor the fire ferrets anymore, but Ryo and I still believe in supporting young talent whenever we can.
That line would be more convincing if she wasn't older than you, Cora pointed out dryly.
Only a month, Minami mock objected.
Then she grinned and added, Anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Most of the group hadn't fully recovered from the festival yet, and between the very early nightfall and the onset of food coma, few were up for anything more than heading back to the Mirai after dinner to get some more sleep. Karana crashed particularly hard. She hit the wall midway through dinner, the wine probably didn't help, and had to be slung over Neri's back like a casualty for the return to the ship. With voices hushed and manners softened as though in a hotel corridor, those who were still conscious enough to do so said their goodnights in the passage outside the Mirai's guest quarters.
Do you need a hand, Azana? Maki wondered quietly as the firebender unslung her semi-comatose partner from the polar bear dog's back, but Azana only chuckled.
Trust me, she said. We've made it home in much worse shape than this. Setting Karana carefully on her feet, she added wryly, At least tonight, one of us is sober.
I'm not drunk, I'm just sleepy, Karana mumbled in protest.
Good night, you guys.
See you in the morning, said Minami as the two fire ferrets disappeared into their stateroom.
Then she yawned herself and looked at her watch, eyebrows rising with surprise.
Goodness, it's only 7:30. It feels much later.
It's been a busy couple of days, Ryo pointed out.
True. Well, I guess I don't need to notify the galley to delay breakfast, Minami said with a smile. Good night, everyone.
There were hugs and sentimental expressions. Then, tired and content, they went their, rather short, separate ways, snugly moored in a quiet corner of Nanisivik Harbor, well away from the freight terminal with its lights and cranes. The Mirai slept.
Eiri Productions Unlimited and Magnetic Terrapin Studios presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Legacy of Korra and the Order of the Rose, Suite for Avatar and Trinity, the Dicho Suite, Fourth Movement, Familiar Spirits.
Well, mostly slept. Cora, still feeling oddly energized from the previous day, didn't head straight for bed. She suspected, incorrectly, that she was the only person on the ship who was still awake, as she went through her customary evening winding-down exercises out on the darkened flight deck. She was working out silently tonight, timing the well-worn exercises in her head instead, but a minute or so after she started, she was slightly surprised to hear music start playing quietly somewhere nearby. She turned to see Corwin leaning casually against the wall next to the hatch leading back into the ship, left hand in his trouser pocket, the orange lines of his Omnitool's minimal mode interface glowing around his right. There wasn't enough light out here to see his face clearly at that distance, but based on his body language, she figured he had to be smiling. She smiled back, then returned to her forms, completing her daily cooldown as a couple more mellow big band numbers played. When she'd finished, timed exactly to the end of Stardust, she favored him with a curious look as she approached the hatchway and said in a low voice, "I figured you'd have crashed with the others. You've got a pretty busy day tomorrow." Corwin shut off his Omnitool and followed her inside, shaking his head. "Not quite yet. There's something I have to do first." He shut the hatch behind them, then turned to her with a smile and said, "We've all been so busy, I haven't given you your birthday present yet." Cora raised an eyebrow. "After everything that's happened over the last couple 3 days, do you really think you have to give me anything more?" she asked him. "No, but I want to," said Corwin, then pointed out, "That's sort of the point of gifts." Cora chuckled and bumped his shoulder. "Fair point," she said. Corwin led the way to the solarium, but rather than cross to the darkened field office, he went instead to the futon, climbing up near the foot and sitting cross-legged facing the headboard. Once settled, he gestured for her to join him. With a curious, intrigued look, she did so, folding her legs under her and arranging herself so that she was facing him, about an arm's length away. "Remember when you took me to the spirit world for the first time?" Corwin asked. "Well, now it's my turn. I've got a little surprise lined up for you there." Cora's look of curiosity increased, but Corwin had already shut his eyes and started the slow, meditative breathing that Cora herself had taught him many years before. She regarded him with a smile that was equal parts nostalgic and wistful for a couple of seconds, then closed her own eyes and sank into herself. When she opened her eyes again a few moments later, they were sitting in a snowdrift under a blazing aurora, many times brighter than could be seen in the physical world, even near the spirit portals. The sensation brought on a surge of déjà vu, so powerful she was vaguely surprised to see that Corwin was still a young adult and not the boy he'd been 9 years before. Grinning as if he'd known she'd thought it, he rose to his feet, took her hand, and pulled her upright as well, then said, "This way," and led her toward the domed shape of a Southern Water Tribe igloo that stood a few yards away. In the air above and around them, spirits flitted here and there on various errands, paying the two projected humans little mind. One, a bee spirit the size of a football, paused briefly on the way past to nod casual acknowledgement to Cora, who waved in reply. Cora entered the igloo right behind Corwin, expecting to find whatever it was he wanted her to see within, only to discover that it didn't have an inside. Instead, when they crossed the threshold, they came out of another door, into a place much brighter and warmer than the one they'd left. Cora made a wordless sound of surprise, shielding her eyes from the dazzling sunlight, then turned to see that they'd just emerged not from an ice-block igloo, but rather a ramshackle little wooden hut. What was more, their winter clothes had gone, replaced by bathing suits and light shirts, and the soft white substance under Cora's now bare feet wasn't snow, it was sand. She turned through another 180 degrees, returning to her original heading, and looked around her with a growing smile as her new surroundings sank in. They were still in the spirit world, of course. That much was obvious from the sky. A beautiful shade of slightly purplish blue not found in material reality, and the vivid turquoise sea lapping gently at the pure white sand of the beach where they stood. This lay in a long, gently curving half-moon bay, surrounded by tall white cliffs topped with what looked like pine forests at this distance. Before them, the sea rolled endlessly off to a misty horizon, the kind of vista that brought to mind literal thoughts of the physical, not eschatological, end of the world. Cora turned to Corwin, her smile of wonder becoming a grin, and said, "That was a nice transition. You've been practicing." With a thoughtful look, she added, "Which is odd, since you haven't been anywhere near Dicho for 6 years." Corwin smiled and replied, "Some skills are portable." Then he leaned and kissed her cheek. "Happy birthday, Cora." She hugged him, returning the kiss with murmured thanks, then released him and turned once more to regard the scene. There was a Water Tribe-style canoe, oddly incongruous in this tropical setting, pulled up on the beach a dozen yards farther down, and not far from that stood a cabaña of sorts, a wooden canopy held up by a couple of poles. In the shade under this stood two lounge chairs facing out to sea with a small table between them. Cora turned to make a wry remark about the need for some umbrella drinks to complete the scene, to find that Corwin had gone, and the door to the beach hut was just swinging shut. "Corwin?" she wondered, puzzled. She was about to go over, open the door again, and request an explanation for this curious behavior. Before she could do so, she noticed movement out of the corner of her eye, swung back, and saw that one of the lounges was occupied. The figure lying there had raised a hand in greeting, and Cora looked more closely. And more closely still. And then broke into a run across the sand, tears of joy springing to her eyes. Arriving at the lounge, she fell to her knees beside it and threw her arms around the person sitting there, who leaned forward to meet her. "Hello, Cora," said Katara fondly, her own eyes none too dry, as she hugged the avatar tight. "Oh, it's good to see you." The Dicho Suite will conclude with the fifth movement, Taken by Storm.